Mouse Audio Podcast Network.
There ain't no sunshine when she's gone, but we're going to keep the sunshine rolling by talking about some badass women from history you probably haven't heard of. Welcome to Whining About History, the Women's History Podcast, where we whine a lot about women that you probably haven't heard of. And we literally drink wine. So
a lot.
Yeah. We whine while drinking wine for the win.
We whine while whining.
Yes. It has been a it's been a cloudy ass week in Minnesota.
Like
the sun has abandoned us.
Like, and I'm just like, it's nice out today temperature wise.
But oh, yeah.
Like, it's, you look outside and you're like, yeah, it's going to rain.
It's funny though, because we had a really long stretch where it was just hot and sunny, beautiful summer weather. At least for me, some people were saying it was too hot. And I'm like,
It has been real hot in Minnesota.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You know what's coming? I need to soak up that vitamin D while I can. I need to put it in my reserves so that, like, early February, I'm not just curled up on the floor going, I'm dying.
I just have a happy light. Not sponsored.
Jared has one I got from the VA and I should use it. I think it's because I don't entirely believe it's going to work. It seems to help.
If nothing else, even like, even if it doesn't necessarily make me happier, it does like make me more awake.
Yeah. But so we had all that like really sunny, dry weather and
it's nice.
It got to the point though where you're in drought conditions where it was like,
I mean, we weren't as bad as like the West.
Well, we're never going to be as bad as the West when it comes to like fires and drought and that kind of thing. But now we've been getting a ton of rain. I'm like, okay. We're good. I think we caught up.
Median
we
ground,
evened out.
Please.
If you could just knock it off.
Right.
You're right about the light thing, though. I definitely do need to surrender myself to the higher power that is the happy light.
Well, I mean, you just sit there. Like, I turn it on when I'm at work because you're only supposed to sit there for like an hour, although sometimes I forget it's on, and then I just sit there all day with it on, and I remember I Googled. Like, I'm like, is that bad?
We were told that Jared was only supposed to use it for like 15 minutes at a time.
And
I was like,
it might be half an hour. It might be half an hour max,
yeah,
actually.
But I'm like, can I OD on happy light? Like, is this a concern?
I think it can cause problems like with your sleep cycle and stuff if you're using it, especially in the afternoon, if you're using it too long.
Listen to two random girls try to figure out how to cure their depression with light.
Yay. And many other things.
See, Kelly, you're the psych grad student. You should have all of the answers.
How about most of the answers?
Most of the answers. You are a year into your graduate studies.
I know, isn't that crazy?
How are you not just automatically a doctor by now?
So apparently, it's similar to consuming like too much caffeine, where you kind of get that like weird shaky feeling and things feel off.
Oh, but that's where I live.
So you can get that. But yeah, it's fairly hard to like overdose on it.
Yeah. Like, I'm not going to go blind or get sunburned.
Well, and you're not even supposed to like look technically like, it's not a direct thing. It's like supposed to be at like a 45 degree angle or something.
Break out your protractors.
Yeah.
You put it at like a 40 degree angle. Oh, no, it's
wrong.
Not,
I'm not
it's
happy.
It's not
now.
Even going to work. Now you're sad. Now, actually, if you turn it too far, it makes you sad.
Right.
But then if you turn it too far past 45 degrees, then it's like you're on crack and you're shaking and you're all wired. Everyone's like, what's wrong with you? It's like, too much happy light. I'm too happy. I'm so fucking
I'm so happy
right now.
Give me a hug.
Oh my God. I need to get rid of some of this happy energy. I'm going to go to the Humane Society. I'm going to adopt all the cats. All the cats. Give me all the fucking cats.
That sounds accurate.
I mean, that's just like me on a normal day.
Right. Speaking of happy, let's talk about our happy juice.
Yeah.
So today we're drinking Jester by Mitolo. It is a 2017 Shiraz from the McLaren Valley.
That is also a very happy name because you know what Jesters do? They make you happy.
Right. So it says, our vineyards are located at the southern end of the McLaren Valley, close to the seaside town of Aldinga. Here, cooling afternoon sea breezes temper the vines, delivering wines of great brightness, generosity, balance, and refreshing acidity. Opulent with dark fruit flavors of plum, blackberry, and black olive, intertwined with soft, silky tannins that lead to a long, savory finish. It is a perfect foil to rustic meat and pasta dishes. Jester celebrates the era where boredom was alleviated through humor and the banal through intellect.
That's what I want for my sexual partner. Long, savory finishes.
for me. Yeah, you know, that's optional for him.
All right. Cheers to this episode being brought to you by the letter H for happy.
And humor.
Happy humor. Ooh, good clink. Ooh, I like this.
I'd just like to also give a shout out to Mama Meg because this is a South Australia wine.
Oh, so she made this. She birthed this. Yes.
Well, when I read Aldinga, like in my mind, I'm like, that's a very Australian sounding city name. It is.
Oh, see, I was thinking Spain for some reason. I just heard L and I was like, okay.
It might be Aldinga. I don't know.
This is really good though. And they're absolutely right about the long savory finish. Like, because it kind of hits, it's got that kick or that like spice that a Shiraz has, and then it mellows out real fast.
It's and like, it just kind of, and it sits on your tongue, but like not in that like gross, like, you know how sometimes it
coats your mouth.
Yeah. But nasty, this is like a good feel. Way.
Yeah. Excellent mouth feel. Way to go, Australia.
Go Mattolo. You know,
oh no, you know what it's like? It's like a wave crashing on the shore with an initial burst of violence, and then the water just gently cascades up before receding back into the ocean from whence it came. See, I need to make writing wine descriptions my full-time job.
Right? Is anyone hiring? You want to hire the two of us just to write your wine descriptions?
Okay, here is my dream, okay? I want to write like a steamy romance novel, but on the back of wine bottles. So like every wine description is like a little more of the story, but it has to be in such a way where it can stand on its own as a wine description. But if you put them all together, there's something going on.
Right.
There's a thread to follow.
That would be cool.
And then everyone has to collect the wines to get the whole story.
And like,
and then it's just bad Twilight fan fiction.
Each bottle, the picture on the bottle is like from like crappy romance novels where it's like a Fabio guy. And
I
like
was gonna
some
say,
gorgeous girl.
It's just Fabio. Oh my god, no! Here's what I want. I want to make a wine where the brand label is just Fabio eating mac and cheese on like a crappy couch. Like he still looks gorgeous, but he's just munching on.
He still
on
looks
easy
like
mac.
An Adonis or something. Yeah. You know, and it has to be like the like. Tiny,
it's
instant.
In the cup. Yeah, it's that shit that I lived on in college. That instant mac and cheese that you just have to
or
heat
like
up in a
cup
microwave.
Noodles or something.
Yes. Oh my god.
So and that's like, what it would be. Every bottle, he's eating something different, but it's still like shitty microwave food.
Yeah. There's the Easy Mac one. There's the ramen one. There's the 3-day leftover meatloaf one.
Right. Yes.
One in one, he's just eating a Nutri-Grain bar.
Right.
I'm just going go through everything there. That I lived off in college. It was ramen, Easy Mac, and Nutri-Grain bars.
All good choices.
That and soda. Like when I was kind of broke, I would drink soda throughout the day to like stave off
Did
hunger.
Did you not have a meal plan?
Not later in college.
I suppose, yeah, when we were like in the apartments and
stuff.
Yeah,
so what I would do is I would buy a 6-pack of like cherry vanilla Pepsi, and I would take one, and that would be what I had. That would be like my meals throughout the day until dinner, because I would just slowly sip on it, and the calories from that would like
you
keep
really
the hunger
like,
nausea away.
You should have upped your game to like protein shakes.
Those are expensive. Pepsi's cheap. And then I did try to get just a buttload of ramen, and I actually got sick of ramen.
Yeah.
And remember, we were trying to pass that off to everyone else in the apartment building. It kept finding its way back to our doorstep.
Like, no.
I'm like, someone take my fucking ramen.
And that creepy guy next door finally took it, but then he wanted to come into our apartment all the time.
Yeah, and then he was like leaving weed in the couch cushions.
Do you remember that
like,
one time?
No.
I don't remember if you were there. Or not.
Oh my god, that was
we were
so
like
mortifying.
Watching TV.
We were watching Lord of the Rings. It wasn't Lord of the Rings. It was the Hobbit.
Yeah, and he knocks like someone knocks on the door, and I think I got up and I like checked, and I was like, it's him. So we're like, shh. And we just like all sat there like,
but we
silent.
Didn't turn the TV off or anything because we're like, well, then he's definitely gonna know we're here. And it was during that part where the
it's like super loud.
Where they're singing about the mountainside or whatever.
Which I love that song.
And God, he knocked a couple more times before finally going away. And I was like, I should be an adult and just be like, hey, man, like, we're having a girls' night. We're not available to hang out.
But I feel like we tried that once because I remember, like, one time he came to the door and he was like, what are you guys doing? And we're like, oh, we're doing this. Like, and we kind of, like...
And he just stood there.
Well, and we didn't invite him in. And then he kind of just, like, walked in. Yeah. And then that's when his weed fell out of his pocket into our couch.
And we're like, dude, we're not getting arrested because you left your fucking weed in our couch.
I remember we went back over there and we were like, I think this is yours.
Yeah.
And your sock. Remember, he left his sock at our apartment.
That was his anchor baby. He was going to come back for the sock and the weed.
I'm like, no.
Good God. College was a weird time, man. And a lot of stuff, I look back and I'm like, how did we, like, accept that as just normal? Or like, okay, this is a situation that I am now dealing with.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, anyway.
Let's do this.
Yeah, so you're going first?
I am.
Okay, cool.
And I'm going to pre-apologize for terrible pronunciations.
Kelly was, like, showing me the pronunciation online, and I was like, oh, damn.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the easier names.
Yeah.
So I am covering Sarojini Naidu. So she was born in a Bengali Hindu family in Hyderabad, India. So that's where we are.
Cool.
I can't set the scene. I've never been there. I don't know what it's like.
It's an average of 95 degrees in the summer.
Probably. Her father was Eghornath Chattopadhyaya. He had a doctorate in science from Edinburgh University, and he settled in Hyderabad after he went to college.
Edinburgh.
Anyways.
It's not Edinburgh. It's Edinburgh.
I said borough, technically.
Yep. See, that's how we say it, but if you're there, you have to say Edinburgh. Because it's so quick where they end up saying brah.
Brah.
What's up, brah?
So he was an administrator at a college in Hyderabad. Her mother, Bharata Sundari Devi, was a poet and then wrote poet in the Bengali language.
She wrote poet?
She wrote poet. She wrote poetry.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because I do the same thing constantly and it just makes me feel so much less alone.
Sarojini was the eldest of 8 siblings. Some of her brothers went on to, like, become more well-known. One ended up being a revolutionary, and another also became a poet like their mother. Sarojini went to school. She passed her matriculation exam and went to the University of Madras, and then took a 4-year break in her studies to kind of, like, I don't know, live life.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm doing now. I'm taking a permanent break in my studies.
Right.
So, what year is this? Where are we in time?
Well, we're about to be in 1895.
Okay. I missed that.
She was born in 1879.
Okay.
I don't know if I said that. So in 1895, the Charitable Trust of the Nizam, which I should have looked up what that is. I think it's like the government, I think. We're just going to go with the government. Gave her a chance to study in England. And that's when she was like, okay, yeah, I'll go back to school. You know, like, if you're going to give me this amazing chance to travel to go to school, yeah, I'm going to take it.
Yeah, I would probably do the same thing.
Especially, like, that's what her dad did. Like, he clearly went overseas to get his degree and then came home, you know. So first she went to King's College in London, and then later studied at Girton College in Cambridge. At school, she met Padapati Govindarajuli Naidu, who would later become her husband.
Aww.
He was studying to be a physician, and at the age of 19, after she finished her studies, and so did he, they got married. This was considered an inter-caste marriage.
Oh, were not of the same social
They were not
class?
Of the same social class. I didn't look into who was higher and who was lower, but both families approved of their marriage, so it was like... It was frowned upon, but because both families approved, it was okay. So clearly none of them were untouchables.
Yeah. So the family basically looked at society and they were like, screw you.
Right. The family was just like, you know what, you're close enough that it's okay. They would go on to have 5 children. I don't really talk about them in, like, the rest of my story because they just end up not being super
relevant.
Important. So in 1905, Sarojini made her first collection of poems. So she'd been writing her whole life, you know, kind of on and off, but obviously with the studies that kind of took precedent. And so by 1905, she was able to kind of, like, strike out on her own. And she named this collection of poems The Golden Threshold. It bore an introduction by another author that was kind of popular at the time's name, Arthur Symons. These poems became greatly admired by Indian politicians, because that's like what she was writing about, was kind of like the stuff going on in India at the time. She wrote another book of poems soon after called The Feather of the Dawn, which unfortunately, like, so she wrote it, but it wouldn't be published until many, many years later after she died.
Oh.
So that's, I find that really interesting, because she wrote it like shortly after that first one, and then it didn't get published for like a while. Like,
you know,
a while.
You know what she was doing though? She was just workshopping it until its last breath.
Right.
Until her last breath.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that quote? Art is never finished, simply abandoned.
Yep.
She refused to abandon it.
Exactly.
She had to die to be like, okay, I guess this is good enough.
Right. So in 1915 to 1918, she began like a tour of India. So I never read it, but I'm assuming at some point her and her husband must have moved back to India.
Yeah.
Because most of my story happens there. So she would go and deliver lectures on social welfare, women's empowerment, and nationalism, because that's what a lot of her poems were about. She also helped to establish the Women's Indian Association in 1917, where after doing that, she was sent back to London along with Annie Besant and became president of the Home Rule League and then the Women's Indian Association. And they presented a case for the women's vote at a committee.
Was that the women's vote in the UK or in India?
It didn't say.
Okay. You know, it's interesting.
I almost grabbed the bottle.
I should know this because the woman I'm going to be covering is a British suffragette. And so I definitely talk about the fight for women's suffrage in the UK. And I'm like, when did they get the fucking vote again? I did this research like 2 weeks ago. So
I know. And that's where mine was too. And I'm like, 1918 and 1928. So they would have already had. So it must have been for Indian. So throughout this time, she really started getting involved in politics and Congress in particular. In 1925, she presided over the annual session of the Indian National Congress. And then she would go on to preside over the East African Indian Congress in South Africa, and where she would actually be awarded a medal by the British government for her work during the plague epidemic that swept through India.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Like, so she was like helping the poor, and I couldn't find like a ton on it because unfortunately, because of the plague, a lot of those records aren't super accurate or around.
Everyone was just busy dying. What, like, was it like, what plague? Like, could you even find out what virus it was?
Well, it was 1929 that she got the medal.
Oh, it could have been. It could have been the influenza.
I was gonna say, I'm pretty sure it was the influenza.
Yeah. Oh, that killed so many people.
Right.
Oh, no.
She participated in the Salt March. Do you know what that is?
Is it a bunch of people wearing yellow raincoats with yellow umbrellas just being real salty?
No.
No? Can we make that, though?
Yes,
because that sounds a lot of fun. I have the yellow raincoat.
So the Salt March, I actually put this in my notes because I was like, just in case, I should just tell people anyway. So the Salt March took place from March to April of 1930 in India. It was an act of civil disobedience. It was led by Mohandas Gandhi to protest the British rule in India. So this is, I mean,
okay,
it's 1930. The British are still in charge of India, which is ridiculous. So during the march, thousands of people followed Gandhi from his religious retreat near Ahmedabad to the Arabian Sea coast, which was about 240 miles.
Oh my God. And this is the Gandhi that we're all imagining, correct?
Okay. Yes, I believe so. Yes. Looking at a picture. Yes.
Can confirm.
Yep. And so Sarojini was actually really close with him, and she participated in a lot of the same conferences that he did. And then after the Salt March, Gandhi, her, and a bunch of other like revolutionaries that had participated were all jailed together. So she went to jail with Gandhi.
I mean, if you're going to go to jail with someone, that's a pretty cool person to go to jail with.
Right.
Like, how many people can say, yeah, I was in jail with Gandhi? NBD.
Right. Upon the outbreak of World War II, she supported the Congress Party's policies and first the aloofness, because they were kind of like us and they were like, we don't really want to be involved in this.
Like, that sounds like a you thing. We're just going to like deal with our own stuff over here.
Unfortunately, I don't. India was on the wrong side of that war.
Were they?
Because They did an avowed hindrance of the Allied cause.
What's avowed hindrance? Is that like we're not siding, but we're going to actively mess with you? Like,
well, hindrance is their hindering, but avowed means, oh God, it's not Skyrim.
It's people. Like, we're going to actively not help you.
I should stop using big words. Openly acknowledge or declare. So they openly declare that they were against the allies.
It's interesting because I always, like, we never hear about India or even Africa when it comes to World War II. We always hear about the European theater and, right, and the Western Front, all that, and then the Pacific theater, which I guess India would be a part of the Pacific theater, but I don't know.
Yeah, like, we should use our book that we have and just talk about the Pacific theater sometime.
Yeah, but I think the only time we've talked about India in reference to World War II before was when I covered Elsie Ott, who did that, like, medical flyover.
Like, I don't think they were super, like, involved.
But she was, like, based there.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, how could an American nurse be there? And, like,
it might be because I don't know when British rule technically ended. Because they protested it in 1930.
Okay, that kind of makes sense why they were like, allies, nah.
Exactly. So I think that's what it was, is they were just still pissed off at the British.
Valid. Wow. We are, we're learning a lot
but
today.
But see, now when I look at Wikipedia, it says the Indian Army was one of the largest allied forces which took part in the North and East Africa. I don't know.
What
Someone from India, tell me your history with World War II.
People from India, please educate our dumbasses.
Right. So after all of this, she took the name, or she didn't take the name. She was kind of given the name, the Nightingale of India.
Mm.
Just because, you know, she was artsy, but she was also super political.
Well, and she was also providing care.
Yeah.
For all those poor plague victims.
She was kind of doing it all. So once, like, India kind of gained independence, she was the first woman governor of an Indian state afterward. Like, she was elected a governor of a state once they were free from the British rule.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, isn't it? In 1947, she was present at the Asia Relations Conference in Delhi, where the Tibetan government representative Sampho Thigi said, quote, "In a similar way, we are very glad to meet representatives from all the Asian countries in this conference, and we wish to express our sincere gratitude to the great Indian leaders, Mahatma Gandhi, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, and Mrs. Sarojini Naidu, and to all the distinguished representatives who have gathered in this conference." So, like, she was well known enough that people were praising her in the same sentences with Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah.
So that's kind of insane. So she continued to play a leading role in the civil disobedience movement until, you know, they became free. And in 1942, she actually was arrested again during what was called the Quit India movement. Again, it was because of the British rule.
Right, right.
I just think that's funny. I'm like, we can quit our own countries. It's also known as the August Movement. And yeah, it was during World War II, 1942.
Oh, you're right.
And it was once again, yeah, demanding an end to British rule. So I wonder if that's why they say Allied Forces, because that means during the entirety of World War II, they were still under British control. So I wonder if it's they were an ally because they were under British control, but they were like, we're not going to support what you do.
Like, we're reluctantly joining in all this.
Right?
And I was going to say, I'm like, I swear to God, India had, like, a massive army during World War II. Like, they did. They were, a really big deal, and we never talk about that.
I know.
And maybe it's because they were like, well, we're here, but we're not happy about it. Which, I get that.
Right. So upon her return to New Delhi after doing some traveling, finally, so we're in 1949 now. She was advised rest by her doctor, and all of her engagements were canceled. However, her health deteriorated quickly and substantially, and many bloodlettings were performed.
Oh, no.
On March 1st, she complained of severe headaches and died after collapsing from a fit of coughing. She was said to have a nurse attending her sing to her at about 10:40 p.m., which put her to sleep. She died of a heart attack at 3:30 on March 2nd, 1949.
So she just got, like, really sick, had a bunch of ineffective, if not harmful, bloodlettings.
Right.
Coughed herself into a coma and died.
So the end of mine, I mean, I have a legacy, but the end of mine is a quote that a man named Aldous Huxley wrote. I don't know who he is. Didn't look him up. And it's, quote, "It has been our good fortune while in Bombay to meet Mrs. Sarojini Naidu, the newly elected president of the All Indian Congress, and a woman who combines in the most remarkable way great intellectual power with charm, sweetness with courageous energy, a wide culture with originality, and earnestness with humor. If all Indian politicians were like Miss Naidu, then the country would be fortunate indeed."
Oh,
I like that. Never once did he mention how she looks.
No, you're absolutely right. It was all about her performance.
Right. Like, I that's why I picked that quote, because I just absolutely love it. So obviously...
Also, she was a snack.
Right? So obviously she was known not only for her literary skills, but for her speaking skills as well, and also just kind of the part she played in working toward Indian freedom from the British, as well as, you know, keeping women's rights still at the front cause as well. So she was a pretty amazing Indian woman.
That's awesome. I've never heard of her.
Apparently, like, a chunk was, my notes got weird. It's apparently what happens when you write them 2 weeks ago.
So I looked up a picture of her just so I could, like, envision this woman as you're telling the story. And in every picture, she's kind of got tired eyes. And they remind me of my eyes, where it's like,
yeah, she looks tired.
Either my eyes look half open, I look kind of stoned, or my eyes are all the way open and I look like I OD'd on my happy light. Right. Like, there's no in between. But when she smiles, she just kind of looks like, yeah, I know.
You can tell,
I know I'm all that in a bag of chips.
You can tell that, like, photographs weren't as big of a thing when she was younger, because there are no pictures of when she was young.
It's
all when she's older.
One photo that might be her when she was younger.
Yeah. But yeah, she was pretty amazing. I think it's awesome that she was, like, arrested with Gandhi, and, like, there's actually a picture of her and Gandhi.
Also, she was a snack.
She was. Like, no, she is not bad looking at all.
Yeah. That's really cool. And yeah, I've never heard of her. And so when you brought up Gandhi, I was like, oh shit. Like, she was Gandhi levels of involved. That's nuts.
Well, and I wonder if it's, you know, people just think of Gandhi.
Well, he definitely is kind of like, he is in our mainstream cultural consciousness. Like,
right,
everyone
exactly.
knows Gandhi. You don't have to know anything about him, but everyone can recognize him, you know? Well, thank you for sharing. Like I said, I've never heard of her.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
Insane.
It looks like she might have her own stamp. Yeah, she has her own stamp.
All right, Herstory stamp collectors.
Get on
there.
That. It looks like she might have more than one, which is awesome.
I mean, if she was, like, a governor and stuff, it wouldn't surprise me.
Right? Yeah, she was a big fucking deal.
I'm Ellen.
And I'm Sam. We're the hosts of the Chaos Cast, a podcast about iconic women in history.
We are two college-educated women with too much useless knowledge. Join us every Tuesday as we fight the patriarchy one episode at a time. Each week, we'll be ranting about how iconic women in history have been done dirty and our variety of hyperfixations.
You can find the Chaos Cast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Stitcher, or on Instagram at Chaos Podcast.
We hope you enjoy the chaos.
All right. Well, like I said, today I'm going to be covering a British suffragette named Rosa May Billinghurst, and she might be better known as the cripple suffragette.
What?
We'll get into it. So Rosa May Billinghurst, or May, as she liked to be called, and as I will refer to her throughout the rest of the story, was born in Lewisham, London, England. It's either Lewisham or Lewisham. I like Lewisham because that sounds like a person's actual name. It's like John Hamm's son.
John
Lewisham's
son.
So she's born on May 31st, 1875, as the second of nine children.
Yeah, we're both going big families.
Yeah. And, like, you know how shows like John and Kate Plus Eight, that, you know, they feature these huge families with an insane amount of kids, and they were really, they were crazy popular for a minute.
I mean, but back then it was more likely that you were going to have that many kids.
Exactly. Because one, there's no contraception. Two, infant mortality rates are crazy. But can you imagine people from the past seeing that and being like, eight kids, hold my beer. Like,
hold my beer while I pop out another one.
I'm sorry, you only have eight kids.
Right.
Calm the fuck down. You are fine. It doesn't get crazy until you hit 13. That's a trip. So at only 5 months old, May was stricken by that pesky childhood illness, polio.
Oh, jeez.
While she survived, obviously, otherwise this would just be the shortest, saddest story ever.
About, just kidding. Bye, guys.
Yeah, 5 month old, dead. That's my story. I did not try at all this week. So she survived, but the virus left her unable to walk.
Oh, which was fairly common with polio, both in young and like adults and children.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, here's a quick history lesson about polio for everyone.
I think you're going to say what I was going to say.
So polio is a virus that has plagued humanity for eons. Like, even the ancient Egyptians were dealing with polio. It was nuts. And it can spread from person to person when the stool of a carrier gets into another person's mouth.
Don't touch poop, people.
Well, and you know, unfortunately, when
back then, sewage
sanitation
is
not great. So this sounds like it could be completely impossible, but it's very easy through food or water contamination and even touch. And remember, this story is taking place in the 1800s and things are not super clean. It can also be passed on via a sneeze or a cough of an infected person, though this is less common. So polio can affect the spinal cord and brain, causing paralysis, which occurs in out of every 25 sufferers. That is horrifying. Can you imagine?
No, I don't want to.
It can also weaken the limbs, and this occurs in one out of every 200 sufferers, and at worst, it can kill you,
yeah.
Which happens to between 2 and 10 out of every 100 sufferers. So those are not some friendly stats. I don't want to be on the wrong end of those stats. Even children who contract polio and recover can develop muscle weakness and paralysis in adulthood. So your kid can get it, they can recover, you think they're fine, and then 30 years old, they're like, I can't move and everything hurts and I'm dying. Which, I mean, same without the polio, like everything hurts, but
that's just getting old.
This fun little time bomb is called post-polio syndrome.
Fun.
Gross. Awful. Hate it. There was no relief from the virus until 1955, when a vaccine became widely available in the United States. While no vaccine is 100% effective, 99 out of every 100 children who are vaccinated are protected. So you have a 1 in 100 chance of getting it after you've been vaccinated. Those are friendly stats. Those are stats I can get behind and give like 2 thumbs up, 5 stars, would recommend.
Right.
So because of this, the U.S. has successfully eradicated polio since 1979. So shout out to the CDC for all that information, all those awesome stats, even the horrifying ones. And here's just like a little personal story. So when my aunt was a kid, she was supposed to go to her best friend's birthday party. And I don't remember how old she was, but they're children, they're little children. And the party got canceled last minute because this little girl got sick. Turns out the little girl got polio and she died. So on the day of her birthday party, she's sick with polio and it kills her.
Jeez.
Like, and that was reality for so many families and, you know, other children. And like back then, it's like everyone knew someone who had been affected by polio. Thank God for vaccines. Jesus. Anyway. May was 1 in 200 sufferers to experience muscle weakness or paralysis. To cope with her disability, she wore leg irons and used crutches or a modified tricycle to get around. Now, I want to describe this thing to you because it's kind of amazing. It has 2 big wheels, like a traditional wheelchair, and then 2 small extended wheels in the front.
Oh.
So like if you reach out your arms where the tips of your fingers are, those are the wheels.
Reminds me of like the sit bikes.
Yes, yes, exactly. And then it's got a single big wheel in the back middle to help stabilize it. So you got the two on your side like a normal wheelchair.
Yep.
You got these like long little wheels out front, and then you got one big ass wheel right behind you to like keep you from tipping back and stuff. And like you see pictures of her in this thing, and it's just, it's a sight because we've done better with a wheelchair. It's like if you told a kid to make a wheelchair with their Tinker Toys, like this is what they would come up with. But it worked for her, and it offered freedom and mobility and independence that she wouldn't have otherwise been able to achieve. Yeah, I'm not shitting on wheelchairs. It's just to our modern sensibilities, this thing looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
So Mae came from a pretty well-off family, and they were able to afford a governess who provided her with, you know, pretty good education. However, her disability prevented her from going to university. I don't know why. Like, this is why accessibility is so important. Can you imagine nowadays? It's like, oh, I want to go to school, but wheelchair. Like, what? Fuck that shit. So Mae's sister Alice worked at a local children's home and got Mae a position teaching Sunday school in a Greenwich workhouse. Excuse me.
That sounds fun.
I'm saying it like a Yank. So a workhouse in the UK is a publicly funded institution which houses those struggling with poverty or homelessness in return for labor. So it's like, okay, you work here and you get like three hots and a cot. We're good.
Right. I would just say at least you didn't say Greenwich.
Yeah. Well, that's what I started to say.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I thought I only heard Greenwich. You could have just gone and I wouldn't even have noticed.
Okay. Well, I have successfully tricked Kelly into thinking I have my shit together. How about you, dear listeners? They know. So Mae was devastated by what she witnessed there. She said, quote, "My heart ached, and I thought surely if women were consulted in the management of the state, happier and better conditions must exist for hardworking, sweated lives such as these. It was gradually unfolded to me that the unequal laws which made women appear inferior to men were the main cause of these evils. I found that the man-made laws of marriage, parentage, and divorce placed women in every way in a condition of slavery and were as harmful to men by giving them power to be tyrants."
Oh, geez.
So she has successfully and beautifully summed up gender inequality and its problems for men and women. Just beautiful. That's all we have to say. Done. Ending the podcast. Mae has written the final word. So this experience put Mae on a mission to end poverty, and she was convinced that women would be the ones to do it. They're like, okay, the guys have been in control for how long and this is still a problem? Let's fucking do this, ladies.
Let's unionize.
But to do that, they would first need the right to vote.
Yep.
Thus, Mae became involved in England's suffrage movement. So in 1887, she joined the Women's Liberal Association, a women's suffrage organization. And in 1907, she joined the Women's Social and Political Union, or WSPU. And I will be talking about the WSPU quite a bit, so get ready for that. In 1910, she became the secretary of the Greenwich branch of the WSPU.
The WSPU. I just love that.
That, like, I'm like, oh, I wish it spelled something, but WSPU, WSPU, that's what I'm going to call it.
WSPU.
Yeah, it's kind of cute, but also, like, a little mysterious, like, Will of the WSPU. So our British listeners are probably familiar with the Daily Mail newspaper and its dubious journalistic reputation. But the Daily Mail is actually the publication that gave us the term suffragette. And this was super cool. I didn't know any of this.
That's really cool. Yeah, that is cool.
I knew there was a difference between suffragist and suffragette, but I didn't really like, I'm like, oh, I know there's a difference. I don't know what it is. And so I'm not going to figure it out until right now. So in 1906, a Daily Mail reporter coined the term suffragette in reference to the WSPU rather than using the term suffragist. It was meant to be like a derogatory jab, like just adding et to the end of something and make it feminine and like meaningless. And so it was like meant to criticize the women who were leading this movement as like, oh, they're just a bunch of little suffragettes, like whatever. They're not doing, like, what can they do?
Exactly.
Like their boobs and their skirts and their femininity. However, the British women were not messing around and adopted the name, using it for their own newspaper.
Fuck yeah.
So they were like, ooh, suffragette.
We're going to take it and make it.
It makes me think of Nevertheless, She Persisted, because that is not an inherently empowering quote. That was said by a man who kicked a woman out of governmental session because she was like, whoa, what the fuck is going on here? And he's like, well, she persisted. Like, she went, shut the fuck up. And we fucking were like,
yeah, we take it back.
That is women's history. She was told no. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted. And we're like, you damn right she did, bitch. Right.
Like, take that.
I love that when people own something that's supposed to be nasty, where it's just like, that's ours now.
Right.
Fuck you. So British suffragettes were serious business. The Wispyu in particular engaged in bombing, artwork destruction, arson, vandalism, hunger strikes, and even chained themselves together for the cause. They were super militant. They were
the very intense.
They were like, we're going to fuck your shit up. And you can end this anytime if you just give us the right to vote. No, we're burning this shit down. And many were arrested or even killed during their activism.
That's sad.
So May Billinghurst was no less intense and regularly attended marches and demonstrations. During a demonstration outside the House of Commons, which is part of the UK's parliament, so big fancy government place, she was one of 159 women who were arrested. She said of the incident, quote, at first, the police threw me out of the machine in reference to... People call her wheelchair literally everything but a wheelchair.
That's great.
Which I'm like, it's a chair with wheels. It's right there, but they call it literally anything but wheelchair. So at first, the police threw me out of the machine onto the ground in a very brutal manner. Secondly, when on the machine again, they tried to push me along with my arms twisted behind me in a very painful position. Thirdly, like she's the way, I love the way she talks. Thirdly, they took me down a side road and left me in the middle of a hooligan crowd, first taking all the valves out of the wheels and pocketing them so I could not move the machine. So they're like taking advantage of the fact that she's in a wheelchair. They're dumping her out of the wheelchair. They're pushing her in the wheelchair. They're pushing her into a dangerous place and then making sure she can't operate the wheelchair to get away. Like, oh, you're stranded here now.
Yeah, like, that's ridiculous.
And while it sounds like the police were definitely taking advantage of the fact that May was in a wheelchair, because they super were, she was not one to be pushed around. Another suffragette at the demonstration said of May, quote, her crutches were lodged on each side of her self-propelling invalid chair. God
wow.
Damn. What? Self-propelling invalid chair.
That's great.
You're just making it really complicated now. Wheelchair. It's right there.
Right. Like, literally, there's a wheel attached to a chair. It's a wheelchair.
I'm going to say this right now. God forbid I ever have to be in a wheelchair, but disability is an equal opportunity employer. If I ever have to be in a wheelchair, I am getting like a license. I'm getting a decal or a sticker or something that says self-propelling invalid chair. Oh my God. Okay, so crutches were lodged on each side of her self-propelled invalid chair. And when a meeting was being broken up or an arrest being made, she would charge the aggressors at a rate of knots that carried all before her. When the police retaliated and tried to control this, she ran the risk of being ejected onto the ground, where she was quite helpless. Of course, she took the risk with her eyes open, and when this happened, as it did on occasion, made full and unscrupulous use of her infirmities so as to obtain the maximum publicity for the cause. So she is charging cops in her self-propelled invalid chair.
Right.
And then when they dump her out, she's like, oh my God, they're picking on the poor crippled woman. Oh my God. And then people are taking pictures, they're reporting on this, and they're like, whoa, the cops are being assholes, which,
right,
like, they are regardless, but like, oh my God. So May is basically turning herself into a freight train and going after the cops who are trying to break up their demonstration. And should they try to toss her out of the chair, she makes them look like shit. And this didn't stop police from straight up tipping her out of her wheelchair at demonstrations all the damn time.
People are assholes.
Yeah. As physical as the suffrage movement was, it was undoubtedly political, and appearances were incredibly important. Opponents to women's suffrage characterized suffragettes as a bunch of stubborn butch women.
Jesus.
Yeah, like, oh, it's just all these, like, butch flannel-wearing ladies who can't get husbands, and so they're pissy and they don't have anything to occupy themselves.
Right. They just need to get laid and be in the kitchen.
They don't have unsatisfying sex to occupy their time, so now they're pestering us for the vote in equality. So to counteract this, the WISPU presented themselves as fashionable and feminine when in public, and they adopted the colors purple for loyalty and dignity, white for purity, and green for hope. So a lot of British suffragettes wore those colors, and they had flags, and they had sashes and hats and like, they fucking accessorized the shit out of this. And it was all political. It was all for appearances, and it was all for propaganda for their movement. The women would wear badges, ribbons, belts, and other accessories in these colors. So they not only looked good and like feminine, proper women to combat these stereotypes, but they also looked united in this unofficial uniform. Right. So it's not like, oh, you need this very specific outfit. It's like, no, grab a sash. Go to Selfridges, grab a sash, you're in. Like, let's do this.
There's some really cool pictures of them all marching. And yeah, like, why they don't look exactly the same. Like, there's that uniform togetherness.
Yes. So as the movement became more popular, hip London shops, like Selfridges, began carrying suffragette swag.
Yay.
And it's interesting because Pride has obviously just ended. And there was a lot of talk this year, I feel, about corporate activism. And how, you know, oh, you can buy Pride swag at Target now and blah, blah, blah. And in a way, that's cool because someone just going into Target, which is this massive franchise, is seeing Pride stuff. And like, how impactful would that be for a kid who maybe is closeted or just anyone to like to see how far we've come where this can be front and center in Target, but at the same time, they're only doing that because they can make a profit and they're trying to capitalize. Yeah,
they're
off
trying
of
to be like,
movement.
See, look, we're friendly, we're all inclusive, and they shouldn't have to do that.
Well, and what were they doing before to help the cause? Nothing, you know?
Right.
So it's
and they're still
like,
not even really helping the cause.
Exactly.
They're more just like, hey, we support it. Come spend your money here.
So it's kind of like that double-edged sword thing. Yeah. And I understand people having a problem with it because it is shallow. At the same time, it's a nice kind of like trail marker for how far we've come because even, 5 years ago, did we have Pride stuff at Target or Walmart or anywhere else?
Probably.
When I was in high school, like, if you wanted a rainbow flag, you had to get that shit off, you know, the internet. You couldn't go to a store and buy that.
Or, like, somehow make it yourself or something. Yeah.
So, anyway, this has been going on since forever.
Yes.
So, May, playing up the fact that she was disabled when police came after her, helped to paint her cause in a positive light and the cops as a bunch of brutes picking on women, particularly a disabled woman.
Right.
This wasn't an accident at all. Fran Abrams, author of Freedom's Cause, Lives of the Suffragettes, wrote that, quote, Mae Billinghurst was no fool. She knew full well, and so did the leaders of the WISPU, that her hand-propelled invalid tricycle, even this woman will not call it a wheelchair, gave her a special advantage in the propaganda battle they were waging. It made it difficult, if not impossible, for the media to portray May as a howling harridan with little care for the safety of others. At its least effective, the sight of her at a demonstration was a picturesque one, commented on lightly along with the other aspects of the pageantry of the day. So it's like, oh, the women were in the ribbons and the sashes and the green and the white and the purple, and then there was this lovely woman in a wheelchair, and she just looked so happy to be there, and that was cute. And at worst, like at its least effective, it's still painting the movement in a very positive light. At best, it served to underline the bold and brutal tactics of the police and the vulnerability of the suffragette demonstrators. And the police were not kind to suffragettes. And there's actually a Drunk History episode about a woman where she and the other women around her basically learned like martial arts because they had to defend themselves.
And
like the cops came at them and they like kicked all their asses. And it was amazing. I want to cover her in the future. So May became something of a public figure and was dubbed the cripple suffragette by her comrades and the media.
Because people are so creative.
Yes. Oh, well, she's a suffragette. And I mean, they could have called her the self-propelled invalid device suffragette, but that was too wordy.
Too much.
Print is expensive. Okay. You need to cut those headlines down. Speaking of media, I found this incredible quote from a reporter describing an instance when May was arrested. And this just like, just listen to this quote. Yeah. Just at the time I was returning to Whitehall, I met Ms. Billinghurst, that indomitable cripple, being carried shoulder high by four policemen in her little tricycle or wheel cart that she propels with her arms. Amid immense cheering from the crowd, she followed the rest into the police station. So the cops are like literally carrying her
in her wheelchair
tricycle or wheel cart. I'm just like, indomitable cripple, my god.
if I ever get crippled, that I want that.
That's gonna be my other sticker. That's gonna be my other sticker, indomitable. I would get that as a tattoo.
Oh, I would too.
So though May knew how to play the victim when necessary, she wasn't afraid to get her hands dirty. She wasn't there just to get beat up on.
Of course.
In March of 1912, May teamed up with another suffragette, Janie Allen, in a window-smashing campaign.
Oh.
And not smashing like they say, oh, that's smashing, like smashing as we're saying it, like we're going to smash this shit. May hid rocks under the blanket that she would wear over her lap, and they went around smashing windows.
That's fantastic.
This did land May in prison, of course. She was sentenced to 1 month's hard labor. However, prison staff had no idea what to do with a woman in a wheelchair or a self-propelled invalid device, so they didn't make her do anything. Instead, May spent her time in prison networking with other prisoners, particularly suffragettes.
Right.
Because there were a lot of them in prison.
Right. She's just wheeling herself around, talking it up.
Yeah. And she even helped to smuggle letters to prisoners from their families. Ooh. Like, I love it.
Badass.
In 1913, May was again arrested after setting fire to a post box.
Oh, jeez.
During her trial, excuse me, I wrote that entirely wrong. Damn typos. During her trial at the Old Bailey, May represented herself, which is not something I would ever recommend anyone to try.
Like, even if you're a lawyer, I still probably wouldn't recommend it.
I listen to all these true crime podcasts, and every time they're like, and then they decide to represent themselves, I'm like, you arrogant, narcissistic piece of shit. Thank you for making it so easy to throw your stupid ass in prison. Ted Bundy style. He did that. He was a nut job.
Yeah, he was.
But like, so I wouldn't recommend it if you're trying to stay out of prison, but that wasn't May's goal. She used her trial. I wrote trail again. What is wrong with
trial?
She used her trial to plead the case for women's suffrage. Her defense was titled, "The Guilt Lies on the Shoulders of the Government," and was published in the Wispy's paper, The Suffragette. Like I said, they named their own fucking newspaper after it. Daily Mail's trying to throw shade, and they're like, bitch, we are the trees that make the shade. We are darkness. Fuck off. At her sentencing, the judge said, quote, "No one could, I think, doubt for a moment, as mistaken as I think you to be, that you were animated by the highest and purest motives in what you did." So that was kind of a, like, wordy quote. He's basically saying, like, your motives were pure. Like, not cool that you burnt a post box, but you were doing it for all the right reasons.
Right. Which is great that, like, the judge is acknowledging that.
But wait, there's more.
Ooh, I like that.
"You do not belong to the class of hysterical women, many of whom are associated with this movement."
Oh, Jesus.
"Who appear to be animated mainly, or at any rate, in some measure by a desire for notoriety." To which I imagine May narrowed her eyes and was like, thanks? Because he's complimenting her while also shitting on literally every other woman in the movement. And he's like, oh, you're not one of those hysterical women causing trouble. Like,
you're normal.
Yeah, like you just seem so put together. It's like, yeah, asshole. Like most of them were. And like, seriously, I have to like give some polite golf claps though, because that is some beautiful Minnesota passive aggression right there.
All right. That was a beautiful like passive shade throw.
Yeah. Yeah. You go, Judge. You salty bitch. So after her trial, that time I actually wrote trial, May was sentenced to 8 months in Holloway Prison. The prison was designated for adult women and young offenders and was recently closed in 2016.
Wow.
That place was open and in operation for 164 damn years.
Good on you.
The building will now be used for housing, and I have never had a better reason to leave everything behind and move to England. Someone just needs to give me money to go study there, and I will move into the old Holloway prison. That will be my flat. Kelly, you will come with me because your school is online, and that's fine.
Not next semester. We're finally going in person.
Okay. Well, go to school in England with me.
Okay. I can do that.
Yeah. So it was a popular place to imprison suffragettes. And basically, you weren't a real suffragette until you got your ass thrown in there. Like, everyone.
That was the place to be.
It was. It was like the happening spot for suffragettes. Like, they're all getting arrested. See you at Holloway, girls. I'll bring the Chianti.
I get the top bunk, bitches.
Yeah, okay. I have had the bottom bunk the last three times, bitch. I have earned the top bunk.
I will smack you.
Do you know how many cops I rolled over in my self-propelled invalid device? I have earned it.
And then they're all looking at her like, how can you get on the top bunk?
Bitches, you will help me because we rise up together. Women lift each other up to the top bunk. Oh, my God. And it was like, this was such a popular place to throw suffragettes that the cops actually spied on the women while they were in prison and took pictures of them so that they could later identify them at demonstrations and in public. Oh. So like the women are out
they're
in
like,
the yard.
Okay, we know that they're suffragettes. Let's take pictures so we can identify them when they're not in prison.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're like out on the street and they've got like a picture of some suffragettes and they're just like pulling up the flashcards like, where do I know her from? Oh, yep. Got the picture
so
here.
We're rewatching Psych. And in one of the episodes, this might be a spoiler, but it's not like a big one. But in one of the episodes, like someone's trying to do nice for someone else and they find what they think is an address book. So they invite all these people over to their house, to the other person's house. And then it turns out it's all people that he's arrested.
Oh no.
And they're like, why do you have a book of people you've arrested? And then he's like, I'm going to go. And he's obviously not happy. So he's like, I'm going to go pack. And they're all like, why? And they're like, because now they know where I live.
Yeah.
But that just reminded me of like, because yeah, like so the person that set it up was like, man, some of these people look really familiar.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because you arrested them.
So May, ever the activist, used her time in prison to continue fighting for women's suffrage. Yay. She led a hunger strike, and in response, the prison staff force-fed her and the other participants. Oh. And force-feeding was no joke. This wasn't they were like, here's some steak. Like, we're just going to wait until you get hungry enough because it smells really good.
No, they'll, like, break your teeth trying to shove stuff down your throat.
They'd strap you down in a chair and shove a tube down your nose and throat. I had to get my COVID swab through my nose. That did not even go close to down my throat. And I was still like, like, oh God, I'm dying. May later recalled, quote, I just laid on my back and endured it all. On Sunday, I was very weak. And on Sunday night, I tried to get out to the bell because my head was swimming round. So I fell on the floor and fainted. My head was forced back and the tube jammed down my nose. It was the most awful torture. I groaned with pain and I coughed and gulped the tube up and would not let it pass down my throat. So she's like puking the tube up.
That would be so painful.
Through her nose.
Yeah, nasal gastric tubes are terrible.
I hate it. Then they tried the other nostril and they found that it was smaller still and slightly deformed, I suppose, from constant hay fever. I love, she's like, yeah, I had hay fever as a lot as a kid, so one of my nostrils was smaller, so they had a hard time with it. Fuck you guys.
Right.
The new doctor said it was impossible to get the tube down that one, so they jammed it down again through the other, and I wondered if the pain was as bad as childbirth.
Ooh.
I just had strength and will enough to vomit it up again, and I could see tears in the wardess's eyes. Like,
she feels bad.
Yeah. Well, they're torturing someone. She's clearly in a lot of pain, and they're like, yeah. Mm. May became sick from the force feeding, for very obvious reasons.
Right.
And there was actually public outcry when word about her treatment got out, and it got so bad that she was released after only 2 weeks of being on a hunger strike. I mean, 2 weeks is a long time to be on a hunger strike, but they were like, okay, yeah, get her the fuck out of here because we're going to kill her or she's just going to die. For her efforts, May was awarded the Wispew's Hunger Strike Medal for Valor. Yes, the Wispew had their own medals.
Yay.
They were going to accessorize the hell out of you. I'm imagining the mother from Mary Poppins, because she was a suffragette.
Yep.
And she had the hat and the sash and, you know, the signs, all that.
She was fabulous.
She was, I want to rewatch that movie because I think I'll appreciate her way more. So not everyone was so thrilled with May and her efforts. She and her family received threats of violence. And one anonymous letter that May's mother received read, quote, "Do not allow your daughter to go out in the neighborhood of Blackheath alone, or she will be it worse cripple than she is now, as she will be treated as a coward, which she is considered to be, for not taking her punishment. If you can leave the neighborhood, do so, as sooner or later she will be attacked, and possibly yourself, as you are much disliked for being the mother of a coward."
Wow.
So people were pissed that she was released from prison early for getting sick from the force feeding. And I could see that if it was someone who wasn't fighting for equal rights. Like, are you fucking serious?
Right? Like, what bullshit?
Yeah. This didn't slow May down, though. By any means. She's good. Like, fucking bring it on, bitches. I will mow you down in my tricycle. She also chained herself to the gates of Buckingham Palace and spoke at demonstrations as a part of her activism. When a fellow suffragette died, she was known for participating in their funeral processions.
Aww.
When a pesky little thing called World War I happened, or as they knew it, the Great War.
The war to end all wars. Wrong.
If only. Like, just get that one really big war out of the way and then we all move on with our lives peacefully. No, it's like 10 years later. Oh, shit, we're doing this again? So when England declared war on Germany, the Wispew and the government came to an understanding. The government released imprisoned suffragettes, and the suffragettes ceased their militant activities in favor of helping the war effort.
Yep.
That didn't mean they stopped campaigning, though.
No.
They're like, okay, shit's going down that is bigger than all of us right now. And we're doing this because we want our country to be better. So obviously we don't want our country to go down in this war. So we're going to stop messing stuff up internally, but we're not going to stop advocating for women's rights.
We're still going to get our message out there, but we're not going to be in the streets protesting.
We'll stop smashing the windows out your cars.
I guess I'll stop hiding rocks under my blanket.
Everyone's like, aww. So the Wispew received a grant from the government and organized a demonstration of 30,000 people in London demanding gender equality in the war. Their banners read things like, "We demand the right to serve," and "For men must fight and women must work." So they were looking for more opportunities to help the war effort that were being challenged by gender inequality. It's like, oh, no. Right. You guys are in the private sphere. You're in the home. You're taking care of the kids. And they're like, I don't know, man. All these dudes are going off to war. Someone's got to.
You need me.
Yeah, you need us. So get your heads out of your asses and let us do our part. Women were desperate to do their part for the war effort, and the Wispy worked with trade unions to allow women to work in traditionally male-dominated industries, which I'm sure were lacking in labor, because in World War I, men could not wait to sign up for, like,
right.
they were ready
home.
To go, and no one thought the war was going to be as long or as bad as it actually was. May kept busy during the war, participating in pro-war demonstrations, not something we hear a lot on this show, and supporting fellow suffragettes in their political ambitions. In 1918, Parliament passed the Qualification of Women Act, which allowed women to serve as members of Parliament. Specifically, it said that women were not disqualified by sex or marriage. So your sex and your marital status could not disqualify you from serving in Parliament. That same year, the Representation of the People Act was passed, which allowed all men over 21 to vote. And previously, there were limitations on which men could vote.
Yep.
So this is something that I actually meant to add. But while they're advocating for the women's right to vote, they're also advocating for voter equality, because it's not like it was only men that could vote. It was only certain men,
right?
Privileged men, certain privileged landowning men of a certain melatonin capacity.
It was like, very, or lack of or melanin.
No, did I say melatonin? You melanin.
You mean lack of melanin?
Yes, exactly. So this thing changed. It's just like, okay, any man over 21 can vote now. You don't have to be a landowner.
Yep.
And before I say something that's totally incorrect, I don't know if this included black men. It sounds like it did, but don't quote me on that. I have no idea. Sure. And all women over 30 who met minimum property requirements.
Of course.
So
it opened up to potentially all men, maybe. We don't know. And landowning women.
Yeah, who were 30 years old at least. So only if you were well-to-do. And it's kind of like as men took a step forward in their voting rights, women also took a step forward, but they're still being kept behind. They still don't have equal voting rights to men. And it wouldn't be until 1928, so 10 years later, that all people over 21 got the right to vote. Jesus Christ. After the 1918 Act, May largely retired from activism. And I mean, she was from a pretty well-to-do family herself, and I'm pretty sure she was over 30 at that point, so she probably got the right to vote during the original Act. She didn't have to wait another 10 years. But she did remain connected to the movement. In 1928, when notable suffragette and friend of May, Emmeline Pankhurst, died, May attended the funeral. And a couple of years later, in 1930, when a statue honoring Emmeline was unveiled, May was in attendance. So Emmeline Pankhurst actually came up a lot in my research because she was a very notable suffragette of the time. She was friends with May, but I really wanted to keep the focus on May because the story was already getting really long. I might cover her, Emmeline Pankhurst, in the future because she sounds like a badass. But right. She was like a big fucking deal.
Yeah, she was. Like, she was one of the more popular
2 ones. Years after she died, they're like, get this bitch a statue. In December of 1933, May adopted an 11-month-year-old child named Beth. Beth's biological parents had to give her up for adoption because it was the Great Depression and they couldn't afford to keep her, which is just like so sad. May passed away on July 29th in 1953 at 74 years old, and she left her body to science.
Yay.
Yeah, so she doesn't have a grave that I could find, so to speak, but not for the normal shitty reasons that we always hear about. Legacy. In 2018, Rosa Mae Billinghurst's name, along with 50 other suffragettes, on a plinth of the statue of Millicent Fawcett in London's Parliament Square was put up. So Millicent was like, she was a social activist, and the statue depicts her holding a banner that reads, "Courage calls to courage everywhere." So it's this woman holding up the banner, and then on the plinth that this woman is standing on are the names of 50 other suffragettes. In 2019, May's adopted daughter, Beth, so this is just a few years ago, she wrote a memoir called Rosa Mae Billinghurst, Beth's Untold Story about her relationship with her mother. And Beth's book discusses her childhood up through age 14 when she was taken out of May's care. So May was her mother from 11 months old to 14 years old. According to the Amazon summary, because obviously I didn't have time to read this book, although I should read it because it's not actually that long. It sounds like the relationship had turmoil, but as the summary states, quote, "Nevertheless, Beth's love for her adopted mother remained loyal until the death of Rosa Mae Billinghurst."
Wow.
So it sounds like maybe they had a complicated relationship that wasn't always super great, but she did love her mother. And that is the story of Rosa Mae Billinghurst, the crippled suffragette.
Yay.
It was a little longer, but it was cool because we've talked about so many suffragettes from the United States.
Yeah, we've never really touched on that. Yeah.
We don't travel to the UK very often. So this was a really cool opportunity for me to understand that whole movement a little better. So,
yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, thank you. So, Kelly.
What am I thankful for?
Yeah, what are you thankful for?
I'm thankful that my therapist could get me an unreally short notice. No, I've been struggling bad, like really bad, with my mental health. And I finally just texted my therapist and was like, shit's bad. Like, and I haven't seen him in like a year, maybe less, but not, it's been a while. And I was just like, shit's not great. Like, can I get an appointment? Expecting it to be like 2 weeks out or something. Like, he's not as bad as some psychologist's office, but I think that also, it helps that I'm already a client technically. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, I have Wednesday or Thursday at 8 or like 9. And I'm like, yeah, sign me up. Like, and it was really good. Like, it helped a lot. And it, like, obviously I know the benefits of therapy, but I always forget and I'm terrified to go. And yeah, but it was like afterward, I felt a lot better. Got some shit to work on.
I'm really proud of you for making that appointment going, because I know how anxious you were about it. I think it's also beneficial. It's beneficial for me, I know, and I'm sure it's beneficial for our listeners to hear that someone who is going for their master's in psychology struggles with the same kind of therapy anxiety that the rest of us experience. Mm-hmm. Like, I still haven't found a therapist yet, which I really need to do, because my medication has helped significantly,
right?
As far as like suicidal ideation or thoughts of harming myself go. But I know that is not going to fix anything. Like, I need to talk it out. I need to come up with strategies to manage my anxiety and things like that. But then my anxiety makes me not want to look for a therapist. Yeah,
it's bad.
But I don't know. It makes me feel a lot better. Like, okay, someone who like should know better struggles with the same thing. You know what I mean? Like, no, this is normal.
Yeah.
This is a normal thing. It doesn't mean you're dumb. It doesn't mean you're broken or weak. Like, this is normal.
Right. And it's okay.
Yeah. I love you and I'm really proud of you.
Thank you. What are you thankful for? I'm like, what went well this week?
I'm really thankful that we got to spend some time outside of the podcast this last weekend. So, over the 4th of July weekend, Kelly and I were going to record, but there was like a lot of stress and anxiety going on.
Yay, and Kelly's mental health.
Well, I was also like, yeah, I'm kind of not feeling it right now. And so we decided instead to like take the week off of you know, releasing an episode. And we took a day and we took like a little day trip together to the Mall of America. And we hit up IKEA and talked about how much we love wingback chairs and sat on couches. And like, oh my God, if I had a really big house, this is what I would buy. Like, I don't know. We just got to kind of like girl out. We got to have some like real talk time outside of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I felt it was a really good time for us to reconnect over something that wasn't exclusively the podcast, right? Because obviously we put a lot of work into this and time and energy, and it kind of permeates our relationship now.
It does, yeah.
And that's been great because I feel like we're closer. I feel like we have more time together. I've loved working on this project with you, but it's also nice to kind of rekindle our the non-podcast aspects of our friendship.
Right.
And that was just a ton of fun. Yeah. I was like, oh man, I didn't know how much I needed this until we got home.
Yeah, I got home and I was just like, that is exactly what I needed.
Yep. Amen.
Yay.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. Please like us on Facebook at Whining About Herstory, Instagram at WAHpod.
Twitter at WAH_pod. Our website is whiningaboutherstory.com and our email is whiningaboutherstory@gmail.com, where we would love to hear from you.
Also, please rate us 5 stars wherever you listen. We actually just got a new one that made me thrilled. They were like, I'm a new subscriber and I love this. And I'm like, I love you.
Right.
Oh, it made me so happy. Seriously, you guys, that is one of the best ways to support the podcast and it costs you nothing. We also have a Patreon, and we are going to be recording some Patreon bonus content right after this. And this is content that only patrons get.
Yeah.
Regular listeners, as much as we love you, you don't get like the audio only or snippets. You get none of this. And I'm going to be talking about some really fun, exciting topics that I know you would all love. Spoiler, it's Boston marriages. So, like, seriously, subscribe to our Patreon for as little as $1 a month to get access to that sweet, sweet content. And this is, like, is this going to be our, like, 6th or 7th bonus episode? Like just for the herstory happenings. Yeah.
I think it's the 6th.
Yeah. So
it might be the 5th. We might have missed one.
That's like 6 hours of content.
Get on there.
Yeah. Cause each episode covers, it doesn't cover a woman, but it covers like a historical happening, event, concept, whatever. And we talk about it. And yeah, it usually lasts for around an hour. It's a lot of fun. We usually get a little more sloppy because we've already been drinking.
Yay.
So yeah. Get on it.
Get on it.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Whining About Herstory. That's Kelly.
That's Emily.
And have an empowered day. Bye.